I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Devin Stauffer, Associate Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. We're discussing his 2018 book, Hobbes's Kingdom of Light, a study of the foundations of modern political philosophy from the University of Chicago Press. Stauffer works on classical and early modern political thought and is the author of Plato's Introduction to the Question of Justice, The Unity of Plato's Gorgias, as well as a number of articles. So first of all, let me say, Devin Stauffer, thanks so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much for having me, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Devin, this is a tremendous book, a comprehensive and systematic interpretation of Hobbes's philosophical project. It really focuses on the text and delves deeply into the text very well. I very much appreciated it. I wanted to ask you first about the motivation for writing the book. You've been working on Plato for much of your career. What made you turn to Hobbes, and maybe what, you know, why now? Why turn to Hobbes now?
Well, as you mentioned, Hobbes is not my first main subject. I came to Hobbes somewhat late, since most of my work had been on classical thought from graduate school on. So I wrote on Plato in particular, but I had always been interested in the question of the divide between the ancients and the moderns, and just what was involved in the early modern rejection of classical thought and the reorientation then. So both to better understand classical thought and its distinctiveness from modern thought, but also with the thought in mind that it was the moderns who had a much more profound impact on shaping our world. And so therefore, I thought important to understand the origins of that. And so I always wanted, and given the educational background I had studied the moderns some, and I knew some things about the moderns, and I could certainly throw around phrases about the difference, but I didn't feel like those phrases in my own mind went all that deep. So I wanted to do a little bit of a deeper dive into modern thought, starting from the beginning, from the origins. And I thought Hobbes was a good entry wedge. So I view Hobbes in my own studies as a kind of beginning of a study of the moderns. I mean, it's not the first time I've studied the moderns, but the beginning of a deeper study of the moderns. And I chose Hobbes partly out of personal taste. I love his directness, his hatred of all things BS. And I've always found him a remarkably clear and engaging writer. So partly it was a matter of taste, but I also thought another place I could have begun would be Machiavelli. And I certainly don't deny that Machiavelli prepared the way for Hobbes in certain respects. But I thought in Hobbes, I could better see a couple of things, both the relationship between modern political philosophy and the new science that emerged somewhat after Machiavelli. And also that in Hobbes, modern thought becomes doctrinal in a way that it wasn't in Machiavelli, and those doctrines have had a very important effect in the world. I mean, just to take the most obvious example, the doctrine of rights and the great importance the notion of rights has in modern times. I thought one could see the emergence of that notion in Hobbes, whereas one can't really see that in Machiavelli. So I thought Hobbes was a good place to jump in. So I jumped in with Hobbes, and as you can tell from the book, my interest in Hobbes wasn't in this or that particular theme in Hobbes. I didn't want to write a book on Hobbes on X or Y, as I had to some extent done with Plato. With my books on Plato are much narrower. So with Hobbes, I wanted to try to take a broad, capacious view of his whole project. And so my book is somewhat sweeping in that regard. I try to cover what I regard as all of the major aspects of Hobbes's thought. So that was the motivation, or set of motivations, that led me to it.
Yeah, that's great. And the book has a, you know, sort of outlines Hobbes's critical project, as I understand it, sort of critique of the ancients and the critique of Christianity, and then works through the positive project, Hobbes's materialism, Hobbes's view, moral philosophy, or his view of human nature and his political philosophy. So it's an impressive synoptic portrait, but it's not introductory at all. It's really a detailed and penetrating reading. So let me ask about your overall picture then of Hobbes. Maybe you could give us a snapshot of what your view of Hobbes is. Maybe the best place to start is thinking about your title, which the title of the book is Hobbes's Kingdom of Light, which is a play on the third part of the Leviathan, the Kingdom of Darkness?
Fourth part.
Okay, sorry, yeah. So what do you mean by Kingdom of Light, and how does that play into your larger picture of Hobbes?
Yeah, well, you're of course right that it is a play on Hobbes's image of the Kingdom of Darkness. And so you can think of the Kingdom of Darkness, or I would think of the Kingdom of Darkness in Hobbes as having two meanings, a narrower one and a broader one. And the narrower one, it's primarily Hobbes's nasty way of referring to the Catholic Church, especially as it's in its political power and political meddling. But I think the broader meaning is not just the Catholic Church, but a broad array of doctrines and forces, both religious and philosophic, that Hobbes thought had blended together in problematic ways and caused all sorts of political problems, but also intellectual problems as well. And that's partly, I think, what the image of darkness is meant to convey, or as he puts it, it's still night among us, or at least a mist, so he thought when he was writing. So it's a play, and so it's a play on that. But what I mean by that is that Hobbes was trying to replace that kingdom, in the broad or strange sense of the word kingdom, with a new comprehensive outlook that he regarded as far more rational and enlightened. And so my Hobbes is a very much a precursor to the Enlightenment, even in its radical features. So what I try to do in the book is look at Hobbes's project, but I think it was a polemical project, an attack on an older order and set of doctrines, and then an attempt to put something that he regarded as much better, both for practical and theoretical reasons, in its place. And so my term, Kingdom of Light, is just a kind of reversal of the Kingdom of Darkness, and I'm using it as a term to capture the outlook that he tried to usher in. Now, I would also say about my title that I also meant there to be a kind of question embedded in the title, or pointed to by the title, which is in some ways a question, I wouldn't say that's the central question of my book, but in some sense the culminating question of my book, which is whether the outlook that Hobbes ushered in, the outlook of what would become the outlook of the modern Enlightenment, deserves to be regarded as a kingdom of light. And so I didn't intend my book primarily as a questioning or challenging of Hobbes from the get-go, but I do at certain times in the book raise some critical questions and reflect on what may be limitations of the Enlightenment that Hobbes promises.
Yeah, and that'll be great to, we'll touch on that. I think a little bit later. Thought also, by the way, by way of introduction, maybe you could say a little bit about how your view is different from some of the other major readings of Hobbes. I guess what I have in mind are a few. I mean, one might say is the reading of Hobbes that puts him in continuity with either the ancient or the Christian tradition. I think I was reading a book review just the other day that claimed, seemed to me improbably, but I think I have a similar training as you, but claimed improbably that Hobbes was an extremely pious Christian, right? So
I mean, that's not an entirely uncommon view. I mean, as I'm sure you know, there's a number of divides in Hobbes scholarship, and one of the most basic divides is just on the central question of whether Hobbes was sincere in his professions of a more or less traditional Christian faith? I think the answer, I try to bring out my own answer to that question in a somewhat gradual way in the book. So I suppose for anybody who might read the book, a spoiler alert, my own answer is no, he was not sincere. So on the basic divide over whether Hobbes was a sincere Christian or not, I'm certainly on the no side. But I should say one thing I tried to do in the book, I have a footnote on this where I address a little bit this dispute between these, let me call them, they're not, maybe not half and half, but these two halves of Hobbes scholarship. And what I suggest is that a little, I think that too much of the debate has centered around just trying to marshal evidence that he was a believer or that he wasn't a believer. And that's fine, and I even think that's necessary. And as I say in the book, I don't think one is likely to get very far at interpreting Hobbes if one doesn't get that question right. But on the other hand, I think especially for people on the no side, on which I find myself, it's not adequate to try to show that Hobbes was not a believer, or even that he was an atheist, because the real question then becomes, well, what exactly were his arguments? What was his critique of the position that, if I'm correct, he rejected? And so what I try to do in my book is to carry things a bit further by digging more deeply and hopefully somewhat more comprehensively than is often done into some of the arguments that Hobbes wrestles on the matter. And that's why, even though I'm on the no side of whether Hobbes was a sincere believer, I spend an awful lot of time in my book, devote quite a few pages to wrestling with his arguments about religion. And one of the arguments that's sometimes made on the other side is, why would Hobbes have talked so much about religious topics if he weren't a believer? Isn't the sheer volume of his discussion of religion evidence of a sincere belief? And so I try to explain, well, what an alternative explanation is regarding why he would have gone to such lengths to discuss the matter. And I think, I mean, it's a complicated thing, but I think there's both political reasons. He regarded religion in at least some of its forms as a terrible political problem. But there's also, I think, theoretical reasons. The Hobbes, as I read him, was genuinely concerned with the truth of the matter and trying to marshal arguments of various different sorts, arguments that operate on several different planes. And so that's why my book has much more discussion of religious questions than one might think, than one might expect in a book written from somebody on the no side of that basic divide.
Yeah, I suppose one of the reasons I'm surprised is, at least my limited understanding of this, the contemporary reception and the reception of Hobbes in the, say, 100 or so years after he wrote Leviathan was seemed to be, to assume that Hobbes was, if not an atheist, then extremely critical of a sort of broadly Christian or religious outlook on the world. So
yes, certainly he had a lot of people attacked him. I mean, most famously Bishop Bramall, but there were also others. Yes, and so most of the hatred that Hobbes stirred up was for those reasons. That's
yeah,
certainly true. But I mean, there is a long-standing view of Hobbes as a believer. I mean, I don't think it's a position that can just sort of be dismissed out of hand. But I certainly do try to argue against it, and I don't myself accept it.
Okay. Yeah, the other kind of view of Hobbes that I have in mind that it seems to, that your book is working against is, I suppose you could say, a view of Hobbes that puts him as a founder of an early period of modernity, as distinct from a later period, say the Enlightenment. You want to see Hobbes as sort of a founder of modernity in general, whereas I think some want to see, so and sort of bring him together with Locke, say, but some want to see him, there's a sort of stronger break between Hobbes and Locke, particularly on issues of political philosophy when it comes to, you know, Hobbes's view of, you know, large security states and limited room for individual freedom and so forth. I mean, what do you have to say about that kind of alternative reading? I mean, I know in the book you do admit that there are...
I don't deny that entirely. There's certainly some differences. And there are some people have argued that Hobbes should be regarded as the first liberal, the founder of liberalism. And I'm pretty close to that view in some respects, but I think there has to be a kind of obvious caveat. I mean, one can't deny that Hobbes accords the sovereign more authority, especially over things like freedom of expression, than those we would recognize as liberals do. And his position on religion is maybe ultimately more open to toleration than it seems at first glance, but it's not simply open to toleration. And his whatever defense he gives of toleration would be highly circumstantial and not principled. And so I, in that respect, I wouldn't regard Hobbes as a principled liberal. On the other hand, I do think he takes certain steps that help prepare the way for liberalism. Certainly the emergence of the doctrine of rights, the more limited aims of government. And I think even in his advice to the sovereign, he urges the sovereign essentially to transgress on liberty no more than is necessary for the purposes of security. So, you know, and by the way, this argument that Hobbes is somewhat more liberal than he's been traditionally thought is certainly not original with me. I mean, Richard Tuck argues along those lines. Judd Owen has argued along those lines. But I do see some connection between Hobbes and Locke, although I wouldn't simply conflate the two.
Yeah, and I mean, you go further, I think, than those scholars in the, I guess you could say, that, you know, the broader Enlightenment project that I think is summed up by the Kingdom of Light idea and the sort of secularism of the state and so forth. I mean, really, you know, you bring out really suggestive passages from Hobbes that sort of bring this out. It's not simply you know, a political element to it, but it's a whole sort of revision of how we think about human beings that was helpful.
And I should add, and how we think about the natural world, right, as well. Right. I mean, I think the one step I take in my book that hasn't been taken so much is the elaboration of Hobbes's natural philosophy. So his, which I'll say as a kind of catchphrase for now, although I try to show in my long chapter on that it's more complicated, but can be called a kind of mechanistic materialism. And I think that's part of the overall project as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that has to be put into the mix, again, both to understand Hobbes's theoretical thought, but I think it also intersects in some ways or contributes to the accomplishment of his practical objectives.
Yeah, good.
He thought a world that accepted this new view of nature would be in some ways both more enlightened but also saner and politically less troubled world.
Yeah, good. So let's dive into the meat of the book. The first part of the book talks about the Hobbes's critique of the ancient political philosophy and his critique of Christianity. And this would be, so we could maybe spend some time on the critical portions of the book. Maybe we could start with the critique of the ancients. I guess I said critique of ancient political philosophy, although Hobbes thought of himself as founding political philosophy. So what's Hobbes's main critique of the ancients? It's a more familiar political theory of Plato and Aristotle.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say a little bit first about the role of that part of the book. I'd say a broad sort of framing thing first. I myself see the book as having, it has seven chapters, but I see it as having four main parts: a kind of brief first part on his critique of the classical tradition, then a second part on his natural philosophy, then my three chapters on his critique of religion would be another part, and then the last two chapters would be his political philosophy, divided roughly into the moral side of it and then the doctrine of sovereignty. So to go back to the first part, I focus, because Hobbes himself directs his readers there, on Hobbes's critique of Aristotle. And Hobbes focuses on Aristotle for a number of reasons, but the most important of which is, I think he thought Aristotle was the classical thinker whose influence had most continued into Hobbes's own time in the rise of scholasticism. And he has that crack in the chapter on darkness and big philosophy, that philosophy in his time had become Aristotility. and so I focus on Hobbes's critique of Aristotle, and not so much on what he has to say about Plato, although I do allude to that from time to time. So now I divide his critique of Aristotle into what I call the moral and political critique, and then the metaphysical critique. The moral and political critique has a number of elements, but probably the most important one is his critique of Aristotle for his excessive reliance on common opinions. So the whole orientation of classical thought, especially Aristotelian classical thought, by common opinions, Hobbes regarded that as, on the one hand, just too flimsy and shaky a ground on which to build a genuine science. So that's one of the, that's connected to Hobbes's claim that Hobbes was the genuine founder of political philosophy, that this thing that existed before doesn't really deserve the name of a science, shouldn't be regarded as a science, in part because it relies on the very shaky ground of common opinions. But I think the further point is he regarded that ground not just as shaky, but also as dangerous, because political philosophy, if it begins from and dwells on common opinions, is merely providing a kind of philosophic weight to a realm divided by all sorts of disputes and passionate conflict that it then serves not to dampen, but merely to inflame. So that's part, at least, of his critique of Aristotle's political philosophy. His critique of Aristotle's, I discuss in my book why the term metaphysics is somewhat problematic, but let me just use it for present purposes. His critique of Aristotle's metaphysics hinges especially on the question or the notion of abstract essences. That is, whether there can be non-bodily essences in the world. And Aristotle's own position on this matter is very difficult of access. And Hobbes shows some interesting awareness that Aristotle's most doctrinal statements are maybe not his last word on the matter. But he's concerned with this above all because he thinks Aristotle provided, so to speak, philosophic food on which the spiritualist beast could feast. So that these doctrines of Aristotle, especially the doctrine of abstract essence, provided all sorts of support for a philosophic framework that seemed to support things like the immortality of the bodiless soul, or various different spiritual bodiless beings, and thereby gave ammunition to people Hobbes mockingly calls the ghostly authorities, by which he means clergymen of various different sorts. And so in that sense, out of a somewhat, what might seem a rather technical, metaphysical or ontological question surrounding this notion of abstract essences, Hobbes finds in that question a real political problem. So that's why that's part of the reason I went into that. The other reason, I suppose, is it shows that Hobbes is objections to Aristotle were also theoretical objections. He didn't think that there was a genuine, solid science there, neither of politics slash morality on the one hand, or of nature on the other hand.
Yeah, I suppose maybe help me connect this up, because I think the more familiar way to think about the relation between Hobbes and Aristotle, or maybe this is just idiosyncratic to me, is to think about Hobbes as critical of Aristotle's view of the naturally political character of human beings.
Yes.
And so Hobbes introduces, you know, the sort of famously naturally solitary individual. So is that, do you see that critique as sort of downstream from the points that you were just making? Or what's the relationship?
Not necessarily downstream. I mean, it's part of the mix as well. I mean, you could weave it in by saying that's one of the opinions that he thinks Aristotle accepted too uncritically.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, I don't know exactly how I would state the relationship of that point to the other points I was mentioning, but I certainly would. I not only would grant that point is part of the mix, but I discuss it myself. So I dwell on that, I suppose, partly just because it is so much more familiar than some of the other points. But I don't mean to deny that it's an important part of the picture. And so, yes, Hobbes rejects Aristotle's notion that man is naturally political or naturally social. In fact, he more or less begins De Cive with an attack on precisely that doctrine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems to hook up in the sense that if you conceive of human beings as naturally social, they might be, human beings are going to be more swayed by social authority, right? Which might play into the problems that you brought up a few minutes ago about the sort of power that doctrines about the immortality of the soul can play into the hands of religious authority. Right, so by conceiving of human beings in one way, it could feed into a certain power being thrown behind one authority or another.
Yeah, and then I also discuss, I mean, the question of man's natural sociality or natural, whether man's naturally political, comes up in the critique of Aristotle in my first chapter, but then it comes up again, or at least Hobbes' side of the argument comes up again when I'm trying to. I have a section in my long chapter on the moral side of his thought. I think a title of it is Man and Morality, where I'm discussing Hobbes' account of human striving. And I raise that issue, his denial of that man is a political animal, there too. And I link it up with his attempt, with his rather stark assertion of the primacy of self-interest, the primacy of self-concern, which I think is Hobbes states that point with a kind of directness that the classical thinkers, I think, would have found shocking. And then also with his attempt to give an account of human striving and human motivation that essentially strips human motivations of their moral character. Now, I eventually end up arguing in that chapter that it gets more complicated than that, but I would tie, for present purposes, let me just say, I would tie Hobbes' denial of man's natural sociality with his claims about the primacy of individual self-concern and with his attempt to deny that we're naturally gripped by morality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose the other side to think about this relationship is the other familiar way of putting the difference between the ancients and, say, Machiavelli and Hobbes, on the other hand, is the way that the ancients conceived of the purpose of politics is aiming high, as it were, right? That the purpose of political association is to deliberate about the good and the bad and the advantageous and disadvantageous. Whereas, say, starting with Machiavelli, you start to see a view that, well, aiming that high might introduce its own sorts of problems. And Hobbes certainly seems to follow in that kind of concern, certainly with his concerns about honor, that this flows into the concerns about honor that Hobbes has. I mean, this sort of, that plays into, seems to me, in your analysis here as well.
I mean, I think it's part of it. I address that at different points in some ways, and so I think the ancient side of that ledger is actually a pretty complicated matter. As I mentioned to you before we began, I'm teaching Plato's Laws right now, and the ancient position on that is a rather complicated one. That, I mean, it's true in a way to say they aimed high, but they weren't quite as naive as Machiavelli sometimes makes them sound. But and leaving that aside, on Hobbes, yes, I think I would put it this way: his limitation of the end or aims or purposes of the political community is a very important part of the picture, certainly of his account of sovereignty, and also of his. But it even is relevant to his moral doctrines, because he's not asking for profound dedication. He doesn't want the political community to ask of its citizens a kind of profound dedication to high and lofty goals. And so, yes, those are somewhat familiar thoughts. I do include them in my account. They are certainly part of the mix.
Yeah, so I thought we could talk about the second part of the critical project, Hobbes's Critique of Christianity. This, I think, takes your book a little out of order, but you do have the three chapters, two on Hobbes's critique of natural religion, and then a natural theology, and a long chapter on Hobbes's critique of revealed religion in the form of the Bible. Maybe you could give us a sketch first of this critique of religion in general. This, because I think for those of us who know the Leviathan really there's a very famous chapter 12 of religion, which you go into in some detail in this chapter. It could sketch a little bit about your reading of Hobbes's critique of natural theology there and in general.
Well, actually, the natural theology, I think, is more the later chapter 31. But chapter right. 12 is, I wouldn't call that his natural theology, but I would say that the role that chapter 12 plays, which is obviously grabs one's attention if one's interested in the religious question, because its title is of religion. But I think that if you look at these different chapters as playing different roles, the role of that chapter is, it's Hobbes' psychological account of religion. And it's where he defends the provocative and inflammatory thesis that religion as such is rooted in a certain kind of fear that's probably better called anxiety, and a certain kind of ignorance, which is an ignorance of causes. And there's a big question, and this, you know, so this goes back to the divide in Hobbes scholarship between those who regard him as a sincere Christian and those who don't. And so they, you know, you could say from my side of that debate, how could somebody who gives a psychological account of religion in terms of anxiety and ignorance be a pious believer? And the other side would respond by saying, well, his account in chapter 12 is really an account of pagan religion. It's not an account of biblical religion. And there's some distinctions that Hobbes does, in fact, draw in those chapters to that effect. It's between what he calls divine politics and human politics, divine politics being God's own direction of things. So my chapter that has my analysis of chapter 12 in it, it's a complicated path, because what I try to do, this is one of the places where I really kind of get in the weeds of the text and try to follow its movement. And I think that when one does follow that movement, it can be shown, if I wouldn't say it's obvious, but it can be shown that Hobbes intended this psychological analysis of religion to extend to biblical religion as well. A sign of that is when he's talking about absurd beliefs that are due to anxiety and ignorance. He uses examples like turning bread into a man, so they're not entirely limited to pagan cases. And then there's other difficulties or wrinkles. For instance, Hobbes in that chapter, it's one of the places where Hobbes unveils what you might call Hobbes's own doctrine of God as the unknowable X at the beginning of any chain of causes. And so he weaves that in as well. And that could seem to provide a kind of support for the notion that that Hobbes is taking a fundamentally biblical position there by defending a creator God. But I try to argue, and it's a rather complicated path, but I try to argue that that's not in fact the case there. So I would say that the main thing that comes out of that chapter, chapter 12 of the Leviathan, or my analysis of chapter 12 of the Leviathan, is the piece of the overall picture that's presented there is a psychological account of religion. And then there's also some quiet indications, I think, that biblical religion actually posed in Hobbes' mind a greater political problem than pagan religion did. So this distinction that seems to save biblical religion between divine politics and human politics ultimately has another implication, which shows that divine politics, by putting forth the more robust notion of a kingdom of God, actually caused a bigger political problem than pagan religion ever did. So it's also part of, Hobbes's critique of religion is very complicated because it has a political dimension of, in other words, an attempt to show that all of the political problems caused by religion, or especially by biblical religion. But it also has a more theoretical or explanatory dimension, where Hobbes is trying to, in this case, give what I would regard as a kind of debunking reductionist account of what he calls there the seed or seeds of religion. Sometimes he uses the singular, sometimes he uses the plural, because, let me leave it at that.
Yeah, well, and the placement of the chapter is interesting because it comes right before, it's the chapter right before probably the most famous chapter in all of the Leviathan on the state of nature. Yes. You have a particular reading about this, which is, we could say a little bit about why you think the religion comes right before it, but it's quite interesting that you have religion coming right before this portrayal of human life and the state of nature as nasty, brutish, and short. That there's some suggestion, it seems, that this could feed into or at least facilitate something of that condition.
Well, yeah, I mean, my interpretation is not exactly that religion itself makes the state of, creates the evils of the state of nature, or is relevant to the evils of the state of nature, because actually religion is sort of the dog that doesn't bark in the state of nature. It's,
right.
My suggestion is this, that Hobbes ends, let me put this, let me put this, Hobbes ends this chapter 12 of religion with a rather surprising turn, because the chapter 12 as a whole is about the seeds of religion and its growth. And so for about, I don't know, five, six or more of the chapter, that's what Hobbes is looking at, the seeds and their cultivation. And essentially the question of the chapter is, how does religion grow from these seeds and into what it then becomes? But then at the very end of the chapter, he sort of reverses things. He says, all right, if that's a process of growth, what's the process of destruction or decay? How do religions decay? And he gives a number of different reasons. And I make the suggestion that Hobbes has a real interest in this question because he himself is interested in the decline and the weakening of religion, and is even ultimately, it's a kind of window into one of Hobbes's ultimate hopes and intentions, that he himself wants to help contribute to a weakening and a decline in religion. That is, of course, not a suggestion that all scholars of Hobbes would accept, to say the least, but I think it, and then so and then I offer the suggestion that that therefore it may not be coincidental that this is placed right before the state of nature, because it raises this thought, which is one of, I think, the main thoughts running through my book, that Hobbes's political philosophy itself has anti-theological or anti-religious intentions. In other words, that it's meant to put forward a moral and political philosophy, one of the effects of which would be to weaken religion. And now, of course, how that could be done, what that means, that's a long question. I try to flesh that out in later chapters. But that's the connection I suggest, or the thought I suggest about why we might get this sort of striking transition from a chapter on religion that ends by with a reflection on the decline of religions, the weakening of religions, followed immediately by the state of nature chapter, which in some sense, if this is not simple, this is a statement that could be challenged, but in some sense, the state of nature teaching is the beginning point of Hobbes's political philosophy. Now, it can be challenged because, of course, there's plenty of things prior to that chapter that are in a certain way relevant to Hobbes's political philosophy, like his discussion of power and the passions and all of that. But nevertheless, I think there's a meaningful sense in which the state of nature chapter is the beginning point of Hobbes's political philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could talk about the critique of revealed religion in the form of the critique of the Bible. You devote a chapter to it, and again, lots of close readings of particular chapters in the Leviathan and the way that Hobbes develops an extraordinarily unorthodox reading of parts of the Bible. Part of what Hobbes is trying to do, as I understand it under your presentation, is to sort of reconcile how it is that you can make sense of some of these biblical passages given his mechanistic materialism. So I maybe could say, you know, give us one or two examples of Hobbes's weird reading of the Bible, and why you take it as evidence of his critique of Christianity.
Yeah, well, let me just give a sort of overview of the general way I take this whole, it's, you could call it the second half of Leviathan, parts 3 and 4, but it's really primarily part 3, which is, you know, a kind of forest that many people don't want to enter for
right.
understandable reasons.
Yeah.
So it's less familiar to many people than other parts of, but because it's a long, long, long discussion of scripture primarily. And so it's obviously the centerpiece for any argument that Hobbes was a sincere Christian was this part of Leviathan. Therefore, as those who have on that side of the argument have said, it's incumbent upon anybody who doesn't think that Hobbes is a sincere believer to explain the intention of this section. What else could he be doing? And so I try to do that. I try to take up that challenge. Now, part of my explanation is, I think, not that unusual, and it's a suggestion that a number of people have put forward, and I think it's a suggestion one comes to, I think, somewhat quickly on reading these chapters and thinking about them, and that is that Hobbes is twisting the Bible to make it fit his political project. So Hobbes gives an interpretation of the Bible that by which the Bible itself is entirely materialistic, and the Bible itself is supportive of Hobbesian politics. The Bible itself supports the primacy of civil authority and so forth. So in other words, you could say the basic message of part 3 of the Bible is that the Bible and Hobbes agree on all theoretical and political fundamentals. And then, so the suggestion is, well, Hobbes was twisting the Bible to turn it into a kind of useful political ally instead of an enemy. I think there's some truth to that, and I try to explain why that suggestion makes some sense and how far it goes. But then the reason I say that in a qualified way is I argue in my fifth chapter that I don't think that's the deepest thing Hobbes is really up to. And I think the difficulty with that is that one thing that, I mean, part of it is Hobbes's reinterpretation of the Bible becomes so implausible that one has to wonder whether he really thought he could convince people that this was a good faith attempt to articulate the genuine meaning of the Bible, or whether he wasn't in fact trying by this mechanism, by saying this, so he'll take a passage of the Bible that doesn't seem to support what he says, and he'll mention it, and then he'll twist it to say what he thinks it says. And I suggest that what he's doing in this is, on the surface, bringing the Bible into accordance with his own views, but underneath the surface, urging readers to reflect on the gap between the Bible and his own views. And given that he's, by this point of the book, tried to establish that his own views are rational views, that has the effect of trying to bring out what he regards as the irrationality of the Bible. So to take one example, I mean, or I could take a couple examples if you like, but one example would be Hobbes's, what Hobbes has to say about hell. He tries to argue that in fact it's not the biblical teaching that nobody according to the Bible is in fact punished for eternity, and that the hellfire is just a kind of metaphorical expression for something far, far milder than that. But then in the course of laying this out, he points to all sorts of passages where in the Bible where hell is described in extremely vivid terms, in which fire is referred to, eternal punishments are referred to. And then he more or less makes it clear that what he's guided by on one level of his argument is an attempt to read away that very harsh surface meaning so as to soften the message. But he also indicates that one reason he's doing that is that it would be too harsh or too cruel of a view of God to ascribe these things to the Bible, which I present as an indirect way of in fact critiquing the biblical God as a kind of harsh and cruel tyrant. So that would be one example. Another example would be Hobbes's attempt to argue that the Bible is consistently materialistic, so that angels are either just phantoms in people's brains or their bodies, but they're certainly not bodily beings. Ditto for ghosts, and this raises all sorts of questions about the Holy Ghost. And so there too, I think Hobbes on the one hand is trying to offer a kind of materialistic reading of the Bible for anybody who's willing to buy the notion of the Bible as a consistently materialistic book, but then on the other hand indicating just how full the Bible is of a kind of extreme spiritualism, which he's critiqued in other parts of the book. So those are two examples. Now there's another very complicated example, which I won't really get into the details right now, but I'll just mention, which is Hobbes's account of the politics of the Bible. So the slowly unfolding political story of, starting from Abraham, but especially of Moses, and then the attempt to establish a kind of workable order that eventually falls apart and then gives rise to an expectation of the Messiah. And then Jesus's coming and what Jesus was up to. And there too, I think there's a similar dynamic or duality at work, where Hobbes is on one hand offering a reading of the Bible that argues it's consistent with his principles, namely his in this case it would be his insistence on the primacy of civil authority, but on the other hand indicating that in fact that's not at all what the Bible in fact teaches, and that and this I think culminates in a kind of political and even moral critique of biblical religion in each of its two main forms.
Mm. Yeah, one of the things that struck me when reading this section of your book is I wonder whether one could read the disconnect, say, between Hobbes's picture of the Bible and the actual Bible, is that perhaps one of the things he's engaged in is trying to rationalize the Bible, that is, make it more rational or why he lines it up with his own system is because he wants to find some kind of rational kernel of the Bible and develop it. I think of this in the context of, because there are other modern thinkers who try to do this, most notably, I guess, Kant, religion within the bounds of reason alone, tries to develop something of this project, that there's this superstitious exterior to religion, but you can find a rational core to develop it. But that's not what you think is going on in Hobbes, right?
I do think that's part of it with not that much, I mean, part of it for sort of rhetorical strategic reasons. Not that he genuinely thinks there is a rational core there in the way a Kant might, but certainly that he's trying to offer a rationalistic interpretation, which I suppose Hobbes would have no objection if some people, even many people, accepted, if it tended towards what he would regard as a healthier, saner interpretation of set of views. It might not be a more adequate interpretation of the Bible, but it'd be a healthier, saner set of views. So I certainly do think he's up to a version of that, but I wouldn't describe it as finding a rational core, but as a kind of rash, taking something that he regarded as not rational and giving a more rational interpretation in quotation marks of it. But then again, I think that that's part of it, but that I think the deeper argument, or at least this is the main suggestion I make in that part of my book, is that the deeper argument is in fact urging a critical reflection on the Bible. You could say this, by he twists the Bible, and in indicating just how much he has to twist it to make it rational by his lights as to what rational is, there's the critique lies in that indication.
So let's shift over to talk about Hobbes's the positive project, as I've described it, which has these three components: the mechanistic materialism in Hobbes's natural philosophy, his moral philosophy and his view of human nature and natural law, and then this political philosophy. So I wanted to first start by asking a kind of general question about the systematic character of his views, which is this, I guess. What the broad question is: what's the relationship among these different parts, which are summed up in these three different books that Hobbes ends up writing: De Corpore, De Omne, and De Cive. So is it? I mean, one reading, I guess, would be to say that he starts with this mechanistic materialism. He's influenced by the new science of, say, of Francis Bacon, and wants to draw the conclusions out for moral and political philosophy based on them. But as you point out, he writes De Cive first, and in some sense he thinks of the political philosophy and writes in this way that it can be taken as independent of those those more fundamental parts, or what could be conceived as more fundamental part. So maybe the idea is that he starts with a kind of political end or political aim, and then thinks back on what views about the world and what views about moral philosophy best fit with that. So what's your view about the sort of relationship among these main parts of his system?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions I had when I started to work on the book. And I was hoping to come to a kind of nice, crisp answer where the pieces would kind of fall cleanly into their places. Mm. And
never works that way.
Yeah, that didn't happen. So I just sort of sketch out some of the complexity of it. I mean, basically my view is it's complicated. So, but let me try to say what some of the complications are. Maybe a way I could put it is to describe my view as between two poles or two extremes, and it's neither of these poles. One of them, in a way you already mentioned, you could say one possible reading, and there's a few people who have, it's not a common reading, but it's not unheard of, would say that Hobbes's political philosophy is simply derivative from his mechanistic materialistic physics. It's just simply a working out of the consequences for human life, for morality, and for politics of conceiving of the world as nothing but matter in motion. And there's a few passages in Hobbes that move along those lines. We can find at least a shred of textual support for for looking at it that way. You already mentioned, I think, some of the reasons not to accept that poll, namely that Dekiwei, which is his first treatment of political matters, which was initially supposed to be the final part of the system. The system was originally going to go body, i.e. de capore, man, i.e. de homine, and then the commonwealth of citizens. So Dekiwei was going to be the third part. But he moved it up. He wrote it before the other two parts. And part of the explanation is he did that for political, circumstantial reasons, because the English Civil War was coming up. But he also indicates that he could do that because it's that part of his system rested on principles of its own. Which he describes as dependent on experience, so not on the mechanistic side. So that's one reason. And then there's other reasons too, like in a important passage in the introduction of Leviathan, where he says that the evidence for his arguments is to be found, the path to his arguments in his own case and for his readers is through a kind of combination of introspection and reflection on experience. So he doesn't say, know the principles of my mechanistic materialism, and then the rest is just derivative from that. So I think that poll that the natural philosophy is simply in the driver's seat isn't tenable. But I think so too is the other extreme poll, which would be to say they have nothing to do with each other. They're just separate worlds. And therefore we can just take Hobbes as a political philosopher, as many people do, and just ignore entirely his natural philosophy, which is nothing but a kind of interesting sideshow, which has faded into obscurity. So I also think that's too extreme. All right, so then what then is the relationship between the two? Well, I think I start from this, that they're certainly kindred in their spirit and in their intention. So both have a kind of debunking reductionist character, and each are parts of a project that Hobbes thought was going to usher in a new, more enlightened outlook in civilization. So they both sort of theoretically and practically have a kind of kinship. But a kinship doesn't necessarily mean that one is derivative from the other. But then there's this question, which I think is very hard to answer, and maybe not even entirely answerable, or a set of questions. One is, to what extent did Hobbes's mechanistic materialism, his mechanistic view of nature, put a kind of stamp or imprint on his interpretation of human experiences? And I think there's some reasons to think that it did put a kind of imprint, that his reductionistic interpretation of human experiences, say the passions, is not unrelated to, even if it's not strictly derivative from, his mechanistic materialism. So in that sense, his view of nature seems to have had an impact on his interpretation of human matters. And then there are another couple questions that also I don't think are perfectly answerable, but at least worth chewing on, is whether he didn't intend his natural philosophy to play a kind of ground clearing, sobering role that would help prepare people to be more accepting of a political philosophy that rests on premises like the premise that violent death is the worst of all evils, and that our concern for security in this world should be our foremost concern. And so here I would ask, why does Hobbes's natural philosophy make a brief appearance, even if it's only a kind of cameo appearance in the opening chapters of the Leviathan? Isn't part of the reason that it's a kind of necessary sobering people up and bringing them into a kind of mood that Hobbes thought would make them more receptive of his political philosophy? So that's a question. And then the most difficult question of all is a possibility that I discuss in my book, whether Hobbes didn't regard his political philosophy as helping to address a theoretical question that he didn't think his natural philosophy was fully adequate to resolve. And that
is the question of whether there is whether there's a creative divine will at the root of things or not. And I try to show in my book that Hobbes was wrestling with that question in his natural philosophy. It was certainly central to his natural philosophy to wrestle with that question, but that he didn't fully adequately resolve it, and that he knew as much.
Yeah, that's
all of, and then so if that's the case, then it opens up the possibility that a political philosophy could help provide a certain kind of supplement to that. And I was very interested in testing that possibility when I undertook the project of writing the book, but I ended up in a somewhat agnostic conclusion. And so in the book, I raise it as a possibility. I don't try to plant my flag clearly in the ground on that question.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it makes Hobbes a little bit different than, the familiar picture of early modern philosophers like Descartes, or say you sort of build, have stable foundation, an indubitable foundation, and you can build upon that. It sounds to me what you're arguing is that each part of the system can have its own independent justification. That is, each, the mechanistic materialism can be independently verified, the view of human nature can be independently verified, and the political philosophy can be independently verified. And indeed, each one of those parts of the system can mutually inform and illuminate the others, which is also a sort of interesting feature of this view. So,
What I see. So to put it in a kind of phrase, I would say, none of the parts is strictly derivative from any of the others, but that they intersect and cooperate in complicated ways.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Hobbes' moral philosophy. And he, of course, the moral thought in Hobbes also has a kind of scholarly, there's insider baseball, I guess, scholarly debate about whether Hobbes is a believer in a kind of natural law, or whether he's on the modern side of a kind of amoralist, one might say. You could sketch briefly your view about Hobbes and how he thinks about morality in the Leviathan.
Yeah, well, I mean, just to say a bit more about the insider baseball dispute you mentioned. I mean, there's this so-called Taylor-Warrender thesis, which is that Hobbes was a kind of that Hobbes's natural laws are categorical imperatives that are not dependent on prudential considerations, but are divine commands. My view is not that, and that view has been argued against by people from a number of different sort of segments of Hobbes scholarship, and I share the reservations, to use a mild term, about that interpretation of Hobbes's natural law. So I share the view that Hobbes's natural laws are dictates of prudence seeking an end that's essentially each individual's own security. So, and more broadly, I suppose I would say that I mostly share what I guess you referred to as a kind of amoral conception of Hobbes's moral thought. But the reason I put it with some qualification is that, and why I wouldn't simply describe my own view that way, is I do think that there's a very difficult question surrounding Hobbes's conception of the right of nature. And I argue in my book that my view of this is shaped partly by reading some things written by others, especially by David Bolitho, on Hobbes's notion of a right, with the question whether that notion doesn't have more of a moral significance than some of Hobbes's seemingly very amoral claims would lead one to believe, and perhaps even than Hobbes himself recognized. And so I address that question, and I do ultimately argue that one can't fully understand what Hobbes means by a right without conceiving of it as a notion that has some moral significance. And so, for instance, to take a piece of that picture, Hobbes seems to draw a moral distinction between motives. You can do anything you see fit in the state of nature, but you can't legitimately do anything you see fit for any reason. Hobbes seems to say that there's a right to do anything you see fit only if your motivation is your own self-preservation. So there's a right to self-preservation. But there doesn't seem to be a right simply to say, conquer others for your own self-exaltation, for the sake of, to just for the sheer joy of the glory of triumph. Hobbes doesn't seem to affirm a right in that case. And the evidence on this is mixed, and I try, partly in the text and partly in some footnotes, to sift through Hobbes's various different statements on this point. And one, I suspect, and I raise a suspicion in my book, that one of the reasons for the somewhat murkiness of the evidence is that Hobbes's own thinking on this point wasn't fully clear. So, I mean, I say that with real hesitation, because I loathe to try to criticize somebody like Hobbes for not understanding something about his own thought. It's too easy. It's easy in that case to just create a kind of straw man. But nevertheless, that's the view I came to. And so that, I guess, puts me in a somewhat complicated position vis-a-vis, if you just drew a kind of stark difference and said there's readings of Hobbes as a moralist and there's readings of Hobbes as an amoralist, it complicates where exactly my own interpretation would fall on that divide. I mean, I certainly primarily on the amoralist side, but then I'll try to. And I think this is not, by the way, this is not just a matter of really nuanced insider baseball interpretation of a few stray passages in Hobbes. I think it ultimately makes a very big difference for understanding the modern notion of a right, which is a cloudier and more difficult notion than I think those of us who grow up believing in rights realize. And what exactly it means to claim a right is a difficult question, and in what way that view does or does not presuppose the prior existence of a kind of moral law. That is a question. I think it's ultimately a question of broader significance than just a kind of very esoteric dispute among Hobbes scholars.
Right. I mean, I suppose the question gets thrust back onto the, I think, underlying value of self-preservation itself, right? Or Hobbes's view that death is the summum malum, and that should be that's the sort of fundamental driver for his moral thought. I mean, the question is, well, so what's the basis in Hobbes' thought for that claim that death is the worst evil that should that animate or grounds the sort of rights claims that we have? And I suppose one could take a sort of moralist or amoralist reading of that as well, that there's a sort of moralist account that could say that that could give a moral view of the importance of our self-preservation. And there's an amoralist view that could take a more anthropological view that this just we're primates that just happen to be motivated most powerfully by death. And
although I think it's a little bit more, I don't think it falls simply on one of those poles. Mm-hmm. I think it's certainly true on the one hand that Hobbes saw our concern to avoid death as just simply a natural fact about our nature, and in that sense having no moral significance. It's just that is how we are wired, according to Hobbes. Full stop, nothing moral about it. But on the other hand, I also think when he speaks of a right to act in accordance with that desire, then it gets murkier. It's not just the strength of the desire, but also the right to pursue it. And also, it also, I think, makes a big difference that Hobbes thought that stable and lasting societies could be built on that concern, whereas they couldn't be built on other desires, like the desire for triumph or glory. And so, in a certain sense, even though the desire to avoid death is just a fact woven into our nature and it belongs to us as self-concerned individuals, Hobbes also saw it as, I think I put it in the book, as the bedrock of a potential common good that can be realized under the right conditions. And so in that sense, and I think that point too is not, it has some bearing on why he is willing to speak of it as a right and not just as a desire. And in that way, it has a kind of moral significance. So there again, I find myself sort of, you know, I guess I suppose mostly on the amoral side, but wanting to add a but about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's finish up discussion about the positive project by talking about his political philosophy. So what's your general take on his political philosophy? How do you stand towards other readings of his political thought? And you place an emphasis on which is understandable, give it its centrality in Hobbes on the importance of sovereignty. So what's your view of Hobbes's view of sovereignty and how does it stand to other readings?
Well, I mean, sovereignty I discuss in my last chapter. And so let me just say this about his political philosophy. In a way, I regard both of my last two chapters as on his political philosophy. So to draw a distinction, I mean, I sort of draw it by the way I divide my chapters, but to draw it, there's no clean distinction in Hobbes between moral philosophy on the one hand and political philosophy on the other. And so I regard my sixth chapter, which is called Man and Morality, as also in a way on his political philosophy and certainly on the more fundamental aspects of his political philosophy. So my last chapter, which is The Hobbesian Commonwealth, is more about just his conception of sovereignty and the Commonwealth. And there, I'm track more closely in that chapter to what others have said than I do probably elsewhere in the book. The main thing that is, I guess, somewhat unique about that chapter is I try to really focus on the question of religion as a political matter. What exactly Hobbes' advice to the sovereign regarding religion is. And I try to show in that chapter that Hobbes doesn't exactly take a principled stand telling the sovereign to do X or Y exactly with religion. I mean, I suppose you could say the principle is make sure that order is the primary consideration, but then I try to show that Hobbes was somewhat more open than, this is not wholly original, but others pointed this out, but it's not the common view, I suppose, that Hobbes was somewhat more open to a more tolerant arrangement than is often thought to be the case. And so I dig into this passage on the knots that have been tied on ecclesiastical liberty, which is this passage late in the Leviathan where Hobbes sounds surprisingly like Locke for a few pages. And so I discuss that, and then I also try to raise this question of whether Hobbes was ultimately urging the sovereign in a more radical direction, not just towards the toleration of religion, but to the weakening of it, and even with a possible eye to its ultimate disappearance. And this would be a particularly radical view of Hobbes's advice to the sovereign. But I try to consider some of the reasons for entertaining that view in my last chapter.
Yeah, I love the reading of the frontispiece on this point. It's the frontispiece is one of the most famous things about the Leviathan, and you know the usual way to look at that is that the Leviathan has the bishop's crozier in one hand and the sword in the other and wields political and religious authority. But you point out that the Leviathan is in fact behind, pictured behind a mountain, and the citizens are facing away from the walled city, as if to leave that city that was dominated by religion. And
right, and that's the city with the church in it. So I
mean, right,
that's the,
right.
That's the connection to the religious matter. I mean, that city is, I mean, if I'm right about that image, and I'm not sure about that, it was a speculation, but if I'm right about that image, then the city is a kind of symbol of the older city, in which the church was still dominant. And some of the political problem of religion or of the church is presented in that image, that all of the images of religion are in some way divided. The church's two spires, the bishop's hat is two parts, the horns of a theological dilemma. And other people have pointed that out. So that's not a new suggestion. The new suggestion that I offered, at least I haven't encountered anywhere else, was the suggestion that ultimately we're not to think of that sovereign as ruling over the city that's pictured, but as leading an exodus away from that city.
Right.
And there, that's why I focused on the fact that the people who make up the sovereign's body are turned away, their backs are turned on the city and they're facing the sovereign. And he's over a mountain range, as if to suggest that he's in a kind of new era.
Right. And the crozier is bigger than the sword and hangs over the city. I would look back at the appendix. It's great. It's as if the Leviathan wants to drop the crozier in the city and leave it
right.
behind.
That's
great.
That's what I had in mind.
Yeah, crozier, that's wonderful.
At a certain point, the crozier could be left behind. It could be left in the city, and all one would need is the sword.
Yeah.
So yes, that was my suggestion. I embrace at the very end of my book as just a kind of also. Partly as some evidence for the more radical reading of the political intention that I've been offering at the end of that chapter, but then also to set up some of my concluding reflections on, you know, modern secular society.
Yeah,
as one of the outgrowths of course, not only Hobbes's project. But.
So I want to ask you about that, your sort of general assessment of it. I want to hand it over to our undergraduate here. I have an undergraduate here who's working on his honors thesis on Hobbes and DeKeyve, and he has a couple questions for you. So Jacob.
So I guess I have a few questions that are sort of related and sort of not. So early on in your first chapter, you bring up Hobbes's kind of reputation for pessimism. And the kind of you call it a tremendous optimism that sits alongside it, I was just curious as to whether or not is that equally present in all of his work? Is that something that tends to appear more in certain works than others, or is it something else?
I suppose it's not equally present in all of his works. I mean, I had the Leviathan primarily in mind when I said it, although maybe his most sort of strikingly optimistic single line of all is in the beginning of DeKeyve, in either the preface to the reader or the epistle dedicatory, I don't remember which, where he says that if his own principles were accepted, it could put an end to civil war, and the human race might never have to, might never fight again except for matters of population expansion. So he seems to suggest that his principles could usher in a kind of new and perpetual peace, mm-hmm. Which is a rather remarkably optimistic thing to say, I would say.
Sure.
And so that would be one place where one sees it in a work other than Leviathan. And then there are other places in De Corpore is where he praises himself as the founder, the genuine founder of political philosophy. But I suppose that Leviathan has one difference from his other works. Some others have noted this. It's a more rhetorical work. It's got a kind of beauty and rhetorical artfulness to it that's not as present in the other works. It's not totally absent in the other works, but he turned on the jets of that when he wrote Leviathan. And so, and I think that's connected with the fact that his optimism can be seen maybe more vividly there.
All right. I don't think I would necessarily disagree with that. So I guess my next kind of point was that, so several times you bring up Hobbes's understanding of happiness. You bring it up in a sort of negative sense at one point, where you say that it's not the sort of contentedness that you might expect from sort of Aristotle in the classics. And then you also bring up his explicit definition in the Leviathan of the human tendency to seek power after power. So in that context, what exactly should we take Hobbes to mean when he says in chapter 13 of De Cive, that it's the duty of the sovereign to ensure a happy life for people insofar as that's possible?
Yeah, I would stress the insofar as that's possible. I think happiness is, let me say, that's where one sees the pessimistic obsolete. I mean, that's a little more clearly. When he describes that life is but a perpetual search of power after power that ceaseth only in death. So that's Hobbes's his description of the meaning of life. And I think on happiness, his essential purpose is this: to bring people to their senses, to pierce what he thinks was a kind of delusion of a grand, exalted, perfect happiness that he thought had been whipped up by classical thought and its fusion with Christian doctrines. And so he's basically, his discussion of happiness is meant to be a glass of cold water in people's faces. And in that sense, you could say it's pessimistic. On the other hand, he does think that if one has sober expectations, they can be genuinely realized. And so in that sense, I suppose you could say the optimism is not wholly absent even there. So if we lower our estimation of what we mean by happiness, then its attainment is possible. Now, so that's the basic thing. The passage in De Cive, he may also have in mind that the sovereign has to be willing at certain moments, if necessary, to sacrifice the happiness of some members of the community if the greater good of order calls for it. Those particular members don't have to like it or even necessarily go along with it, but since he's advising the sovereign in that case, I think that may be part of what he means.
Okay, and so for my last question, you mentioned several times the sort of end of sovereignty as it's understood by Hobbes as a sort of mere peacekeeping. And I guess my question is, do the four realms of liberty and do the kind of, I guess, insidious recommendations that Hobbes is consistently making in Leviathan for the sovereign add up to something like a self-imposed extra limit on the sovereign?
What do you mean by self-imposed extra limit?
So I guess to be more clear about it, that if the sovereign is to follow right reason, that there are certain limitations beyond what would be indicated by the capacity of the sovereign.
Well, I think Hobbes wants to at least counsel the sovereign not to extend his purposes too far, not to try to do too much and to limit the aims that he's seeking. And so, in other words, not to go on grand projects of moral reform, not to try to turn the people into his image of what a virtuous community might be. And so in that sense, he wants a sober, prudent, cautious, sovereign who's not a tyrant. That's why the word popped into my head. But on the other hand, he does leave it ultimately in the sovereign's own judgment to so he doesn't put external checks or limits on the sovereign. So in that sense, he does leave the sovereign. And that you would say, on the one hand, he leaves the sovereign in principle a very free hand. On the other hand, he tries to counsel the sovereign in the prudent use of that very free hand, and not to try to do all sorts of invasive things in the pursuit of grand ends. And so that's another way in which Hobbes is at least somewhat closer to, you know, modern liberalism than first meets the eye. The first part of that point shows why he can't simply be regarded as a modern liberal, but the second part shows, I think, why the distance is perhaps not as great as it sometimes seems.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll
thanks, Jacob.
Back to Dr. Church.
Thank you, Jacob.
Yeah, so Devin, thanks for being generous with your time here. I just wanted to finish up and with your view of your assessment of Hobbes. I wanted to ask a particular question, though, see if you weigh in on this, which is is there a place for philosophy or the philosopher, or what is the place of the philosopher in Hobbes's state?
Yeah, I mean, I think Hobbes doesn't say a whole lot about that. Just one of the big differences between Hobbes and the, you know, Plato, who I've done, as we discussed at the beginning, I've done quite a bit of thinking about Plato, is that, you know, the philosophic life and the place of philosophy in the political community is not really a central theme of Hobbes. I mean, certainly there is the role of Hobbes himself, the grand architect, as he refers to himself at one point, of the structure he envisioned. And so in a certain sense, there's not a place for exactly the philosopher as such, but for a philosopher, namely Hobbes himself, as the architect. But how he envisioned the place of philosophy, he doesn't really discuss it that much, so I suppose one has to guess. I think Hobbes thought that the new order would free philosophy from, I mean, he thought in some ways one of the problems of the kingdom of darkness in his view is that philosophy was, so to speak, shackled in that kingdom. It had been forced to serve essentially non-philosophic forces, and its own doctrines and thoughts had been distorted in the process. So I think Hobbes thought that his new order, you know, go back to my image, the kingdom of light would be very good for intellectual life. You know, and then there have been arguments that others have made that one of the unfortunate consequences of the whole modern development is that it eventually put us in a condition that we have plenty of freedom for philosophy, all the freedom in the world, but some of the soil has been depleted or diminished. I have some critical reflections on Hobbes at the end of my book. Those critical reflections aren't primarily along those lines, although I think they're ultimately compatible with that thought, and you know, and that is a thought that I myself have reflected on and think has some truth to it.
Yeah, well, you want to say a bit about your critical reflections?
Well, at the very end of the book, I try to conclude with a sort of, you know, all right, all of this, and now why don't I weigh in a little bit? And well, I mean, there are other moments in the book where I sort of weigh in, but I try to end the book with a kind of on the one hand, on the other hand ending. And on the one hand, I try to express my admiration of Hobbes for the boldness, the audacity, and the humanity of the project that he attempted. And, you know, Hobbes, my study of Hobbes deepened my affection for Hobbes. And so I wanted to kind of give a tribute. And I brought Nietzsche in the mix partly to show that I don't have sympathy for the hysterical anti-modern reactions of the sort that Nietzsche, if not himself displayed, at least inspired in others. And that there's a kind of case to be made for Hobbes' sobriety over and against that. But on the other hand, I also try to suggest that the rebellion against some modern notions, some Hobbesian notions that can be seen in Nietzsche is not without some warrant in human concerns, and that there are important human concerns that the Hobbesian conception of things doesn't really do justice to, and that, you know, that some of the problems that have emerged in, you know, later modern life, I think, do have their origins at the beginning. And so I try to say a kind of brief word. I didn't want to end the book on a rant, but I did want to end the book by saying that I do think that there was a price to be paid for the gains that were also made by this project. And so, and that those, you know, I would say those prices have a moral dimension, of a human dimension, and they also have a philosophic dimension. I try to at least allude to all of those things at the end, but I don't really elaborate it all that much.
Well, Devin, it's a great book and a great conversation. So thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, thank you very much. It was great to talk to you, Devin. I look forward very much to seeing you in person.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Association for Political Theory for promoting the show. And thanks to you for listening.